you know, I think if two people know the same thing, one of them is redundant.
See, why can't that be an opening? That's pretty funny too. Hey, it's Tuesday. What is today? What's the date today?
It is the 19th, March 19th.
The 19th of March. And this is episode 47 of On Taking Pictures. We're here each and every week talking about the art and science of making images. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadeandblurred.com. With me, way over yonder or up the road a piece.
Nice.
Fancy New York photographer, Bill Wadman.
Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I had a flood in my apartment this weekend.
It was nasty. Yeah, I saw the photos.
Yeah, and we have our boiler for our hot water. Not our hot water to drink, but our hot water as in to run through the pipes to keep our heat on, is in a little like room on the roof, like this sort of like built room on the roof. Because it's a very old building and they rebuilt it, and apparently that's what they decided to do. And our heat didn't work last week, and so they came to fix it, and the guy did something which did something which, anyway, he left, it was working, and then about 2 hours later, apparently a valve blew on the boiler somewhere completely unrelated to where he was working. And about 50 gallons of water filled that room.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. We were actually on the phone, and you're like, I think I hear water. Hold on a second. And then it was like, I got to call you back.
Yeah.
our roof just caved in.
Yeah. So there was water coming in, and then it was going down the wall, inside the wall, and then coming out where the radiators go into the wall. Like there was that much water.
Did you say it went all the way down to the mailboxes in the base or in the first floor?
Four floors down. It went all the way through the wall down to the mailboxes. And then so I finally got a hold of the guy, and he sent the guy back, and I'm talking to the management guy, and he's just, and this is Saturday, of course, so I have to call like the, you know, the emergency line, and because the offices aren't open, and he's like, well, you know, wherever it started, make the hole bigger. Basically, like it's trying to go wherever the drip started, and because it couldn't all come out there, then it's spreading and then going other places. So you're off making a bigger hole. In the one
isolate
place.
It to as few areas as possible.
Exactly. Now, so we, you know, pulled out our 13-gallon IKEA-y trash can thing and put it under the thing, and I smashed the ceiling with a hammer and opened up like a 8x6-inch hole with the claw side of the hammer, and it poured out as if I was like, as if it was the faucet of the tub, like that kind of level of water. Where it was filling up this bucket every few minutes. And then, at the point at which we kind of got it under control, because we got it coming out of one place and there were towels everywhere. Half our apartment had water on the floor. Luckily,
you have hardwood floors, thankfully.
Hardwood floors.
That would have been a mess with carpeting.
Oh, yeah. None of it was anywhere near my computers and stuff. However, the wall that it goes down is also where the power is or the breakers are.
Oh, like your breaker box? Yeah.
So I was like, okay. First thing first, like all the breakers go off. Computer goes off, then all the breakers go off, then computers get unplugged, you know?
Yeah. So you've got no power, no heat, and it's like 30, 40 degrees outside.
Yeah, and there's water pouring in, yeah. And so, but at the point at which you kind of get it under control, then it becomes this, what does it become? I don't know. It's like you can start to laugh about it.
Right.
Just because it becomes...
Yeah, once you've taken the sort of element of danger or serious damage out of the way.
Right. Yeah. Now it's like, okay, now how do we deal with the damage that has been done? Which, you know.
Right.
So the guy gets back, gets up on the roof, because it's in this hut that I don't have keys to, otherwise I'd go in and figure it out. But it wasn't. I couldn't get in. So he goes up and shuts off the water so it stops draining. And I had emptied out this trash thing into the tub like three times while Heather held some other sort of thing, you know, to hold the water off.
Right.
And then I didn't realize that in one of the times that I had done that, I hit the edge of the tub so much that I broke off one of the feet of the...
Oh, shit.
Right? So I just pulled off all of these like feet thing that are on it, but not realizing that the foot that I broke off actually broke a hole in the bottom of the bucket.
Right.
So I put it back down and it's going and I'm like, there's still water spreading. Where's the water coming from? Figuring it's coming from. And it turned out it's coming from like a, you know, 2-centimeter hole in the bottom of the bucket that I'm capturing.
Bummer.
So anyway, long story short, that was our weekend was doing that. Yeah. But it gave us a good excuse to clean everything.
100 pounds of wet towels and sheets down to the laundry.
Literally probably 100 pounds. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was not a good time. But you know, we survived. You know, it kind of brings me into one of our guys on the Google Plus community. I think it's was it David Rabouin? Talked about.
Okay, first off, Google Plus community going great guns.
Yeah.
Thank you very much to those of you who are in the Google Plus community. Several of you have joined Google Plus just to be part of the community, and we appreciate that. Lots of really cool discussion going on. Some good photos being posted.
There's like 50 new people a week.
Yeah. One of the photos that we were just talking about is this vintage Mustang on this old highway. Goncalo Martins. I'm probably going to butcher your name. I'm sorry, but I love this shot. Bank Job, it's called. Yeah, I like it a lot. The only thing if I'm going to be really picky.
Yeah.
The flares on the headlights, a little heavy-handed.
Okay.
But other than that, I love the sunset, love the sort of empty road kind of thing. Yeah, I like it a lot. And then there was another one of this sort of cloudy peak.
Yeah, that's a nice shot.
Kind of desaturated, a little warm. Peter Evans posted that. Lovely shot.
Yeah.
And okay, can we talk about what a nut Joe McNally is for a second?
Oh, Joe McNally up on top of the Burj Dubai?
Yeah. Up a half mile in the air, standing on top of this building.
Couldn't pay me. If somebody says, I'm going to fly to Dubai and let you hang out somewhere for 6 months, you know, in a nice hotel room.
Yeah. But you have to stand on the top of this building.
For 30 seconds? No, thank you. I'll stay right where I am. Thank you.
Yeah, no. Anyway, I'm sorry to derail. You were talking about
So one of the posts last week was David Rabouin said, who has kids and, you know, if you do have kids, like don't not take pictures of bad times, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah. We always take pictures of the bad times as well as the good times.
And I think it was a really good point and something I hadn't really thought of that much because I tend to take pictures of the good times too. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, his story was that the family was moving across the country or something, and the truck broke down while they were going, and there's pictures of his, like, little kids next to the truck that's broken down on the side of the highway, whatever it was, right?
Right.
But now they look back on that, and it's like, oh, remember that trip where everything went to crap, you know?
And he got a great picture of his daughter with a dog in the back of the truck. Did you see that one?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there's something to say for that, and I bring it up only because – you know, Heather and I were laughing eventually about this water coming through the roof while it was coming through because it was like, this is just so absurd. Who would have ever thought it would rain inside? Only to then think of that drabble that I shot of my friend Cynthia a couple of years ago where she's on the floor with the umbrella.
Right, with all the jars around her.
Yeah, so one of the jars that I used in that picture actually was grabbing water from a drip off somewhere else on the ceiling. And so I bent down and I took a picture at like ground level and I was just like, you're drabble, like actual size.
Yeah,
And she's like, oh my God, like what is going on over there? But we took some pictures of Heather with an umbrella inside just to be silly, you know, because you're going to want to remember these things later. You know, when my father was really sick, I took some portraits of him. And he had lost a bunch of weight, and it was a few months before he died, so he wasn't that bad off. But you know, it wasn't looking good, and he was looking very chemo-y. And I took some pictures of him on a blue background. And I was a terrible photographer at the time. Well, at the time is in air quotes.
I don't have to say anything.
And I actually, you know what? I considered. Yeah, I know, right? I will say that I considered for a moment actually taking pictures of him after he had died and before they took his body away.
Right.
Because he died at home. And
what stopped you, if you don't mind me asking?
If it happened today, I probably would. Mm-hmm. At the time, well, first of all, it was in the middle of the night. So what am I going to do? Set up lights, you know?
Sure.
At the time, I felt like my skills weren't worthy of the task.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It would have been an approximation of the moment rather than the moment.
Yeah. Like, I think I could do a decent job at it, whatever that means, now.
In fact, I bought
a Hasselblad in some ways for the purpose.
Okay. I couldn't look at my mom after she died. They asked me if she died at the hospital, and they asked, do you want to go? And I couldn't move. I wanted to.
Yeah.
I couldn't move. I mean, I just...
Were you in the room when she died?
No.
Okay.
No. I had stayed there, and I left to go home and take a shower and come back, and that's when she died.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that from other people. Yeah. I was there when my dad died, and I actually, well, not to go macabre, but like I actually watched them take his body out of the house and put it in the truck, and like I had to bear witness to that.
Looking back on it, I wish I would have, just to your point, just so that there was a mental, even not even photographing it, just so there was a mental picture of that moment.
Yeah. And you know, not to get off of the doom and gloom, but there's something to say for those moments are as important to us as memories as the good times. You know?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, don't get all Nan Golden about it and let your boyfriend beat you up and take pictures in the mirror for art. That I do not subscribe to. But as far as, you know, this is a sucky situation that, you know, is an accident or happenstance or something. You know what? Like, we should record this for posterity. It's like, okay, well, we don't want to remember the bad things. Well, you know what? You don't know how you're going to see that bad thing in 10 years' time.
Yeah.
That
and
might be a turning
part of the
point.
Human experience, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that it was a really good point that David made. And I just wanted to bring it up on the show because, yes, you know, having 50 gallons of water come through a hole in our ceiling is somewhat, it's frustrating, and I was pissed and whatever it is. It's also pretty comical, you know?
Yeah.
And so Heather has already started calling it the great flood of 2013, to which I replied that we should really wait until the December 31st to actually give it that name for fear of something even worse happening. But anyway, it was interesting. And so don't forget to take pictures of the bad times. You know, we had all this stuff. My sister had a baby a few months ago, and my niece is blind. She had some problems late term, and I took pictures of the baby when she was born and all this kind of stuff, but I almost wish I had taken more pictures the night before. You know what I mean? The run up to it,
right?
So that it's a story and not just a snapshot. You know, of a baby.
There's more of a context or a narrative there.
Yeah, and that's not the kind of stuff that, I mean, this kind of goes into that thing we talked about a couple weeks ago, that woman with the guy who got out of jail who beat up the girl and she was there. You
right,
that
the Times
thing?
The Times piece, yeah.
That I kind of think that, like, and not for that kind of thing. I would never publish the story of my father getting sick and dying. Like, that to me... It just doesn't sit right with me.
Sure.
Cause that's not,
but for somebody else, it might.
For somebody else, it might. Yeah. I don't like that. And not that I don't think that people should see it or whatever it is, but like, you know what? There's plenty of people recording death in this world. I don't need to gain from that in some way. Does that make sense?
Sure. Sure.
But anyway, so something to do, and in fact, it's got me thinking about it, and it's going to make me take more pictures in the future. In fact, I need to take more pictures in general. I take a lot of my pictures that I take are, you know, we're going to set up this thing and do this picture, or we're going to take this time and do this picture. I'm not as spontaneous as I used to be, and I need to get back to that.
Right.
Can I
make one suggestion?
Sure.
Just be sure to back it up.
All right, so
a lot of people chiming in on the backup issue.
What have they said?
Well, I mean, you know, for those who haven't listened to last week's show, was it last week?
Yeah, it was.
I had a little external drive snafu and lost a bunch of data. Willard chimed in and said he had bought a NAS enclosure. I think Alan Bailward that had an 8-disk version, like eight drive version of the Synology thing.
Yeah, that's a serious box.
Yeah, Alan's got a pretty serious backup situation there. But you know, I'm glad people are at least discussing and you know, maybe in some way the show helped make people aware that hey, you should back up your stuff.
Yes, I also wanted to say, you know, I got an email. A face mail, as my mother calls it, a message on Facebook.
Face mail?
Yeah. It's so genius. My mother calls them face mails.
Trademark.
And she also when she sends somebody an email in Gmail, she calls it Gmailing somebody.
Right. Okay.
Which is genius. Love my mother for that. And he said, so this guy that I, my friend Cliff from when I was younger, like high school all the way down to, I think, first grade or, you know, fifth grade, something like that. My buddy, he facemails me, and he says, he's like, his cousin is a photographer and posted this on his Facebook page. And I hope I'm not going to get in trouble by saying this, but I think it's a good terror kind of situation. Can anyone offer a bit of advice here? One of my Drobos is on the verge of becoming a brick. Seems there was extensive directory damage. I've been able to get it to mount again, but not able to read or write from it. I ran Disk Warrior and successfully found the errors, and it wants to rebuild the drive. The issue is that about 2/3 of the way through, Disk Warrior quits. I've tried 5 attempts, 3 of them using FireWire 800, 2 of them using USB 3. Same fail issue. Please, any ideas of what to do? 16 terabytes on the line. Okay. So number of things here.
This sounds like not only a potential drive hardware thing, but a problem with the Drobo itself.
Yeah. First of all, I would use USB 3 over FireWire 800 pretty much any day of the week now because it's a lot faster. Because I'm sure the new Drobos can saturate FireWire 800. If they can't, then that's the one thing about Drobos. They're not very fast. Even the ones that are supposed to be fast aren't that fast. But I'll put that aside for the moment.
I'm sure they're great, but I seem to know an above average number of people who've had problems with them.
Okay, so here's the stick of the matter here is, and this goes
16 terabytes.
Yeah, well, this goes for the people talking about NASs online too. Yes, your NAS can handle the fault of one drive. What happens if the NAS hardware fails?
Yeah, and that takes down one or more drives with it.
Right. What if your multiple drives fail? You don't want everything, all your backups on one. It's, you know, if you want to use a NAS or you want to use a Drobo as one of at least two places where your stuff is,
mm-hmm.
I'm fine with that. But
have one NAS backup to another or have one Drobo backup to another?
Something like that, yeah. But having it, it's safe because it's RAID 6 and it can deal with two faults. Yeah, the Drobo can fail too, or... you know, all kinds of nasty stuff can happen. What if somehow in the backup process, some of those files get corrupted somehow?
Right. Now you're backing up corrupted files.
Exactly. Like there's all those kinds of things, which people don't always think about. So it's kind of a, you know, I was writing back to Cliff. I was like, man, I don't know. First of all, I've never owned a Drobo. Mostly because it's sort of the whole idea of having a black box that does everything, like data goes in and don't worry, we'll take care of it.
Right.
That scares me. I personally don't like that. I don't trust it. Even though I know I use a RAID 0 as my thing, but I back that up twice anyway. I just use it for the speed. The idea of using just one of these things as sort of your archive of everything you do is a bad idea. It's unless you are also backing it up somewhere else. You know, if
either to another box or offsite or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I even with the RAID stuff, like I understand RAID. I've used many different kinds of RAID, external, internal, RAID 5, RAID 1, RAID 0. But there's something about having at least one copy of your data on a non-rated device, mm-hmm. which makes me feel better. You know, like I know it's a single pain point because if that drive fails, whatever it is, but like as one of your backup options, have it be a thing that's not split across 12 drives.
Right.
Then you can always plug that into a hard drive dock, you know, or USB or whatever it is. Like that's not as reliant on the stuff on the drive, you know, the drive hardware.
I just got an ebook by Gavin Goff. Okay. Do you know this? Do you know Gavin Goff?
No.
I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. I think it is. Anyway, it's called The Photographer's Workflow, and it's this guide basically to everything related to Lightroom and Photoshop workflow, from offsite storage and backup to naming conventions, folder and directory structures, all this kind of stuff. And I'm finding a lot in it that helps me because I'm starting from scratch now.
Right.
So that might be something if you guys are looking for, you know, there are a lot of people out there that have great workflows and, you know, you've talked a little bit about yours. I'd love to actually at some point talk about your workflow from import on.
Yeah. We can do that next week. We'll find it for the show notes or do a couple of searches. There's a DAM and assets management, digital asset management workflow that was developed for like the, it's not the NSA or like the Library of Congress or somebody, there's some governmental version of it somewhere, some like free mm-hmm. version of it. That is just really cool because it's, you know, like we got a bunch of people together and this is what they said, and this is what the government's going with, you know?
Okay.
It's really, really kind of cool that it's, they actually went around and actually did it.
Okay.
So we'll find it and put it in the show notes.
Okay.
Yeah, put a note in there and I'll go look for it after the show. Let's see. I'll put a note here. Okay. So backup. Yeah. Make sure you backup. Anything else we want to say about that?
No, I'm good on that one.
Okay.
You've got a thing tomorrow.
Yeah. So
you talked about it a little bit.
Today is Tuesday. Tomorrow is Wednesday. And, on Wednesday night on the 20th, I am going to be presenting some of my work along with two or three or four other photographers, at a photo salon, it's called, that Jay Mazel and a couple of other big photographers started doing monthly years ago. And you get up and you show some of your work for 15, 20 minutes, and then everyone else does the same, and there's a little Q&A, and it's a really good time and a good way to see a bunch of photographers work and talk to them and ask them questions. So I will be presenting tomorrow night. I think it starts at 7:00. It's at Soho Photo, which is on White Street. I think it's 15 White Street. Soho Photo. Yes, it's 15 White Street in Manhattan. So if you're in New York City and you want to meet me in person or see me talk about my work, you can do that. I think it's $10 or $5, $10 at the door.
Or meet Jay Mazel. You know, either way.
Yes, or meet Jay Mazel. Most of the time Jay is there. Sometimes he doesn't make it because he's, you know, busy being Jay.
he can't find his way out of his house.
Pretty much. So I will be there talking about myself. In fact, I did it once before a couple of years ago and showed just sort of a broad overview of my work, mostly portrait stuff, like sort of
this
straight
wasn't
portrait
the,
stuff.
The Drabble talk, was it? That was something different?
No, that was different. That was different, but that was at the same location. So,
okay.
In fact, I'm going to see if I can get Claude to come down and videotape me, although it's not going to be all that exciting. Maybe I could
with his Blackmagic cinema cam.
Yeah. Maybe if I could just get the audio recorded, I can do an overlay of the images.
Yeah. That would be cool.
Yeah. Maybe I'll try to do that. So anyway, 7:00 tomorrow, at Soho Photo, I'll be talking along with some other people today. I'm going to be showing actually a bunch of stuff from before and afters of Photoshop work. So here's this image out of the camera and here's where I got to with it. And then talk about, you know, where initially when I started doing that kind of work, why I started using Photoshop to improve, quote unquote, my photos, and then how I took steps along that line and got deeper and deeper and deeper in. I think it's a kind of an interesting talk. I have like 50 slides to show. It should be fun. So go check that out.
This is a nice dovetail. We should go in this idea of when you do a lot of compositing, you do a lot of revisions for compositing. How do you wanted to talk about how you know when you're done?
Yeah.
And I think that's applicable to anybody who's trying to do something creative, whether it's writing a song or, you know, writing a book or a poem or a script or painting or editing photos.
Yeah. Or even taking photos. I mean, sure. You know, you could sit there and try to get the right picture of the Brooklyn Bridge. I mean, eventually you have to let it go and say, either I have the shot on film or on sensor,
right,
or I don't, you know.
I just watched something, and I'll see if I can find it. But basically, it was this idea of storytelling, and the speaker was talking about how many photos, on average, are taken for each feature article in National Geographic.
Oh, what is the number?
29,000 images.
29,000 images to get the 4 or 6 images that they use.
On average, 29,000 and change images per story to get what they're looking for.
I wonder if that's the same as it was. I mean, no one. I doubt that they were taking 29,000 images in the film days.
Probably not, but
I mean, that's like a truckload of film.
Yeah, that's a lot of images.
Yeah, and it shows you how hard it is to get the shot you want sometimes. You know?
Well, and the kind of the thrust of this of the video was that in some cases quantity begets quality, because you keep working an image or you keep working a situation or working a setup and looking for that one great photograph instead of a bunch of good photographs.
Yeah. I think that there is there's a line between that and spray and pray, right? So there,
sure.
Where is the – is it taking a ton of pictures? I mean, this is kind of goes back to – we talked about Robert Frank last week.
Mm-hmm.
And some people on the Google Plus community took me to task a little bit, saying that I was just saying my argument that Frank took 30,000 photos. Yeah, at least 80 of them are going to be good. And I still somewhat stand by that. And yes, that's the case for everybody, right? But there's something to say for taking a lot of photos to get the right one. But he was taking – the thing about him is that he was taking 29,000 – I can't guarantee this. He could have taken, you know, 15 photos per shot that he was trying to get. But I don't think he was sitting there going, snap, not moving at all, snap, snap. A lot of photographers do that.
I think he was working the subject, yeah, or working a situation. Yeah, absolutely.
Right. And I think that that is a mistake that I know that I make sometimes when I'm shooting portraits for magazines or whatever. That mm-hmm. I will spend a lot of time taking essentially the same shot. Now, the problem is that when it comes to my subjects, I may not be able to get that shot exactly, right? So I'm taking shots waiting for them to come into the target. Does that make sense?
Right.
You know, I'm shooting in some ways with digital. I can shoot and I know that none of those pictures are going to be the good one. But if they think that maybe, oh, okay, maybe he's got it now, and they let their guard down, that's when I can get my shot.
Well, a lot of photojournalists, even McCurry shoots that way, where he'll find a stage, if you will.
Yep.
And wait for the action to take place. Wait for something interesting to happen within that stage.
Yeah, like Cartier-Bresson waiting at the top of the stairs for the biker to come around the corner.
Sure.
And I think that, so. I do that sort of in a more one dimensional way of just waiting for the subject to loosen up, you know. And I can afford to throw away a lot of that kind of stuff. But I plan on doing that from the get go, right? I don't. But I don't. Ex- how do I say this? Sometimes it doesn't work and I have to move on, right? You know, it doesn't always the same thing and you got to try different stuff. And you and the subject are sort of doing a dogfight.
Right.
In sort of a metaphysical air, you know?
But that's part of what I love about photography, and it sometimes gets overlooked, is we sometimes go out and take a bunch of pictures and then try and make the best of what we got instead yeah. of shooting and recognizing that point of, I'm just not going to get this, so I need to move on.
Yeah.
What I'm looking for, either in my mind's eye or through the viewfinder or whatever, it's not here. I need to move on.
Yeah. Well, the flip side of that is, especially when I started doing jobs professionally and there's people sort of watching over my shoulders, is coming to terms with the idea that I am the one who says when we're done.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a...
Not the art director or not the creative director, whatever.
Right. There's like a power in the fact that, like, you know, yeah, I've got this, we're done. And it's a scary power to wield sometimes, especially if... Because you have to trust that what you think is the truth, you know? Do sure. I actually well, have the picture that I think that I have? Do I have all of what I need? Is there a certain amount of... there's a certain amount of fatigue that sets in eventually with a subject where even if you shot 100,000 more pictures, you wouldn't get better results. So
right.
you need to know when to cut your losses and let it go, you know?
Yeah. Or just knowing what's not going to work. Yeah. I mean, we've laughed about this before, the Testino story yeah. where he was it either Vogue or Vanity Fair hired him to go
Vogue,
shoot.
Because it was in that movie, that documentary, that
that's right.
September
that's
issue.
Right. The September issue.
Yeah.
And they hired him to go shoot the Colosseum and he's,
that did not work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did not like those pictures. I will not show them to you.
Yeah.
Can we see them? Yeah,
No,
he's Mario Testino. So he can do that. Right.
But there's
a certain, you also want to get to the point where you can, much like a performer on stage, you want to leave them wanting more.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can leave your subject where it went faster than they thought it would be, then it's like, oh, we're done. You know, it's sort of like going to the dentist, you know, it's like,
yeah.
oh,
yeah.
that was fast.
And you show them either the back of the camera or the iPad or whatever, and they see, oh my gosh, wow, yeah. you got some really good stuff yeah. and it didn't take very long.
Although I never show my subjects at the shoot.
Really?
Never. No.
Interesting.
Yeah. Last week at that CBS thing I had to do, I showed a few pictures to the PR people because they were like harping me.
Mm-hmm.
But just to show them that the light was nice and, you know, they could trust me that I knew what I'm doing.
Right.
But yeah, I don't show. I would never show somebody on the back of the camera unless the pictures were really great coming out of the back of the camera and they were really awkward. And mm-hmm. if I, in showing them would somehow make them loosen up.
Sure. Like set them a little more at ease.
See, look, yeah. you look beautiful. Oh, yeah, I do look beautiful. You know, that kind of thing. That every once in a while that can work. But it's very rare that I would ever do that. We kind of got off topic here. Not off topic, but in the same kind of way. I mean, knowing when to stop in shooting is a tough thing even right there. There are a number of places where this happens. So that means there's knowing when to stop shooting, then knowing when to stop editing the photos down and choosing the ones that are the ones. Then when mm-hmm. you're actually editing the pictures and doing something like a composite, knowing when to stop that. It's sort of like for a writer saying like, you know what? No, there needs to be another character. Like, no, there are enough characters and enough subplots. I need to revise the ones that are here.
Right.
You know,
right. Stop with the feature creep and just tighten it up.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. yeah, that's a good quote. do you think that is easy thing for other people?
No, I think it's another skill. I think it's another skill of, look, there are a lot of photographers who they think they're really good. And
yes.
maybe they're not.
Right.
But in through their eyes, they're fantastic. And it works the other way. There are a lot of photographers who are very self-deprecating, but you know, I look at their work and I go, oh my God, if I could ever take that shot, right, I would be happy.
Yeah. I think the thing is, though, you can't look at your work or somebody else's work and base your opinion upon 4 or 5 photos. You know, this game is a larger body of work kind of thing. There are a lot of people who can take 3 or 4 or 5, got lucky and took 3 or 4 or 5 great photos. But how do they look every time out? You know, not everything that I did. I had a shoot last week that I am not super happy with. They're fine, but they're not great. You know, not stuff that's going to end up in my portfolio. And there's a little bit of a jab, you know, in me that's like, oh, you missed that one.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, do you look at it and go, look, you should have been able to nail this. This is nothing you haven't done before.
Sometimes there's just no inspiration. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make, especially with portraits, you can't make something amazing. Amazing is a little bit of pixie dust that comes in when it wants to come in, like the weather.
Sure.
And you can't force it. Somebody wrote on the Google Plus the other day about, was it Alan? Somebody wrote in saying that they took pictures of some model. And you know, the pictures he was very unhappy with them. And no matter what he did, she kind of looked like a wet noodle, I think is the term he used. Sometimes that happens. You know, sometimes I take pictures of somebody and I cannot for the life of me get them to look anything other than stupid. You know, I mean, and I think that the bottom bar of my range has come up so that my worst pictures are still passable. I still feel that way a lot of times. In fact, I did the other day in the thing last week where I was just like, these should be better than they are. And I'm going to try 15 different things and they're still not blowing me away. So what am I doing wrong? It's not easy. But here, let's get back to the original topic.
Hey, you're the one going down the rabbit holes, man.
I like the rabbit holes. I'm fine with the rabbit holes. I'm just saying that, you know, let's take that Dave Hill picture that I did with the guitar.
Yeah, and that went through half a dozen iterations that I know of.
Yes. And Dave Hill's this comedian, guitarist and a comedian, and he's a nice guy. And I had an idea for this picture of him up on stage that I was going to shoot him in the studio and then composite a stage together to have him like playing on stage, like rocking out. So I sent him an email. I was like, hey, let's do this. He's like, oh yeah, let's, you know, whatever you want. So he came over the next week and I had him standing up on my, coffee table in my living room area. And I put some lights on the back of him to sort of mimic sort of gelled lights that would be on stage, like sort of red, you know?
Sure. Like the little par cans or something.
Yeah. And then had the gridded beauty dish up front to sort of be sort of a spotlighty kind of thing that was a little softer than just a hard light on him, coming from the front off to one side. And I shot these pictures and they're fine, you know? And I kind of had an idea of what I wanted. Like I knew he was going to be on stage and I knew he was going to be in some sort of rocking out pose, but I didn't know how it was actually going to come together. Sometimes I know exactly what I'm going to do. And that makes it easier because it's like, okay, either this works or it doesn't. It's sort of like a use case for a piece of software, you know?
Right.
Does it do this when I put this in? Yes. Okay. Well then it works.
Yeah. Okay. This part's done. Move on.
Yeah. Where this was a little more open-ended. So he comes over and he's up on the coffee table and he's playing and I get some shots and we're chatting and we're just, you know, doing the thing. Now he's used to being up on stage. So getting his picture taken is not a big deal for him. And then I had him like go down on his knees. So he was really pulling it back towards the end. And those are the shots that I ended up using, right? Cause they're the most sort of dramatic.
Right.
I didn't know how I was going to do the rest of it. I ended up taking the picture of the back of a bench in the subway station and used that as the front of the stage because it was just this beat up stained wood. I used the Marshall stacks from the picture I took in December of Todd Reynolds in the subway.
Right, in the subway.
The busker shot.
I actually thought you shot some new stuff, but they worked
no,
pretty well.
No, same one. And I, you know, and I messed with them a little bit, so they weren't quite the same. But yeah, I have a sort of a velveteen curtain backdrop thing that I have in a bag that I pulled out and made into a curtain on a rod and took some pictures of it and then merged a bunch of them together to be the curtain behind him. And then tinted it red instead of black, you know, shot a whole bunch more of those lights so I could just have a bunch of them racked up behind him. And so I started putting it together, and you and I mean, I showed you a few of the revisions during the middle of it where I was like, ah, it's almost there. It's not quite, yeah. You know? And then we ended up putting, I had the idea to put that big sign behind him, that, you know, having it say Dave Hill behind him in lights.
Right. Like the Elvis or the Morrissey kind
right.
of.
And we, you and I tried, you and I went back and forth a little bit, cause you were just like, oh, you could do it this way. You could do it this way. And I was like, how about this? And you were like, no, try this. And then, you know, we went back and forth a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that is what it takes, but there's a point at which you don't, I think when to stop in some ways comes with experience of just knowing when to let go. Okay. It's never going to be 100%.
No,
it's never going to be perfect. So don't be mad when it's not perfect.
No, there's a great expression that they used to use, in the scene shops in theater. It was beat to fit, paint to match. And sometimes that's what you have to do, right? You either run out of time, you either run out of money, or you either run out of resources.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make it work within that time frame or within those resources or for that amount of money. And that's an equal challenge to just giving yourself carte blanche with all of those resources to take as long and do as much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's also, I mean, I have friends who are musicians, friends that are painters, friends that are writers who write a lot or make their music a lot, but never actually do anything with it because they could never let it go. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But look, that's in my opinion. Okay. This is just me. My opinion is the final step of creating any art is releasing it into the world.
Yes.
It's not done until you release it. And whether that's making a print, pressing a CD, you know, whatever it is, printing a book, whatever.
Putting it up on your blog.
Yeah, putting it up on your blog. That's the final step.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff isn't, in my opinion, again, for our own enjoyment. It's for the enjoyment of everyone else. It's for the consumption, the commentary, the discussion of everyone else.
I agree.
That's when it becomes something.
Yeah. And a lot of the people that I know, it's like they write or they make music, whatever it is, and no one ever hears it. You know,
mm-hmm.
They work for years on a single story or a single song or a single whatever and redo it. And, oh, I'm going to do the demo again. Oh, I'm going to rewrite this chapter. And, oh, I got to go back and open this up in Photoshop because this shadow's not quite right. And it's like, you know what? Somebody was saying that it's like when you have good ideas, there are people who don't want to actually use the idea because it's so good. It's so precious that they don't want to waste it.
Mm-hmm.
You ever hear that kind of talk? You know, I have an idea for this business, but I'm not ready to make it go yet because, you know, it's right. Not the right time. And
what are the odds that it's ever going to resurface? Probably very slim.
Yeah. Those people will never do anything with it because they're holding on to an idea as if it's something that they own. And that's not the way it works. An idea is like, inspiration is like Tinkerbell, you know? If it's there, you got to talk to it and you got to let it move on because you got to use it while it's there.
Could that be the new On Taking Pictures t-shirt?
Inspiration is like Tinkerbell.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, you know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people are collecting these ideas as if they are intrinsically worth something. And it's like, they're not worth anything unless you do something with it.
Right.
Nothing. It's like, okay, you have a great idea for a song. Okay, you have like four chords, or you have an idea for a story, and you've written, you know, the first few chapters, but you can't make it. Then it's not done. Yeah. You know, go finish it and let it go, and then we'll talk. It's like people also think that they're never going to have another idea, so they have to save this one. Well, the only way you're ever going to have more ideas is if you do this one and let it go, and then another idea comes. You know, you will only get better at using those ideas and getting those ideas and being inspired by being inspired and acting upon that.
Sure.
You know. So I had this idea. Dave came over. We shot the stuff. We put it in. We played with it. And then you and I went back and forth a bunch. And then I went back and forth a bunch with myself. And I ended up sort of in this place where it felt done. Now, there have been, when I first started, I think I'm a better compositor than I used to be. A few people on Google Plus have been putting up things that are saying just like stuff along the lines of, you know, it may not be as good as Bill, but here's my attempt at compositing. You know, there's been a few
right.
the past few weeks.
Yeah, quit doing that.
Well, because it's like, I great, you know, composite away. But I am certainly not I'm good, but I'm not that good. You know,
right? That's what I'm saying. Is don't put it up for comparison. Own it. Put
right.
it up.
It's like, okay, you made the thing. Great. You know, super. And you know what? Your next one's going to be better. And the one after that's going to be better. If I showed you my compositing stuff from 2005, you know, it was a hell of a lot worse than all of you in the Google Plus thing. And there, and what I'm doing now is a hell of a lot worse than, you know, the stuff I'll be doing in 3 to 5 years, hopefully. Now I think that I am at the level now where I am not at all embarrassed to show my stuff to people. And some of my compositing is good. So good that people don't realize it's composited, which makes people think that my pictures are easier than they are.
Right.
You
right.
know, oh, you took the picture of these people telling a ghost story around a fire. It's like, yeah, but there was no fire there. And these people were from a separate shot from those guys. And there's no hand. And there's,
you know, here's where the hand was. Yeah.
So you get into these situations where you almost have to explain. It's so transparent. You have to show that there's glass there, you know?
Yeah. Sure.
We went back and forth. Now, I put it up on my blog, that picture, and somebody pointed out something that I missed. And this happens, right? Sometimes you walk away and you come back and you go, oh, I messed up. Now, with the stuff that I do, it's all about matching light and getting things to look seamless and like, oh, if this Hivu was really there, that would cast a shadow over here, or there'd be this little rim of light there, or, right?
Right.
And this guy realized that there was a shadow underneath his arm on the face of the guitar that wouldn't have been there if there was that much light coming from the spray of sparks. And the problem was that his arm was there and there was a shadow there, and it's very difficult to get a shadow off of a complex thing underneath it. And it bothered me. And so I actually went in and tried to fix it, which was also very hard.
Right. Revision number 42.
Exactly. Right. and you know what? It happens, you know. And I went back in and I tried to change it, and I changed it and I made it better, but I still wasn't happy about it. And then I was lying in bed like 2 days later, and I remembered that there was actually another shot of him after he had done the scrape across the guitar, he strummed and then he put his arm up like he was, you know, pointing to the sky, which meant that I had a very similar shot of the front face of that guitar without his hand over it. So I actually went back again and found that guitar and put that front of the guitar in, and I think now I'm done.
Right.
You know? But sometimes you miss stuff, and sometimes other people have to say it. So thank you to whoever said that. I can't remember who it was, but, knowing when you're done is hard. And I think that one of the things that I taught myself by doing 365 portraits or whatever is that, you know, it's got to be done because you got to do another one tomorrow, you know?
Right. And I think that's something that, I love. I mean, we've talked about limits before. I love self-imposed limits. I love that you say, okay, I've got X or Y and I need to adhere to that. And then you have to let it go. It forces you to let it go. And again, for me, that letting go process, whether it's something as simple as a blog post or something as complicated as a painting or you know, anything in between, it's the letting go that's the final step.
Do you have a hard time doing that?
I used to a lot more than I do now.
Okay.
Lately, I have a lot more trouble starting than anything else.
Sure.
But, you know.
Yeah, there was a start. I'm watching Deep Space Nine at night. Yeah, I know. I've never watched it. I've never, you know, so Conrad and I have been watching it when we've got nothing else to watch at night to relax. And there was an episode where Jake, the son or whatever, who's supposed to be a writer, quote unquote, mm-hmm. gets taken in by this crazy woman who's sort of like a vampire who like sort of inspires artists, but then like sucks out their power.
Space vampire. Yeah, yeah.
And but one of the things she kept saying was, you know, like, just write, stop censoring yourself,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just let it flow and whatever. And it's a little different with photography, but it kind of gets into the idea of, even when you've got a huge shoot and you're editing, where's that line between self-censorship and which is holding you back, and self-editing, which is refining yourself?
Sure. Okay.
You know, do you ever kind of get there?
I'm not deep enough in it.
Not even with, yeah, but okay. You took a lot of pictures at, where'd you guys go this weekend?
We went down to Corona Del Mar. I didn't take very many. I took maybe a dozen pictures.
That's because you're using your camera like a film camera.
That's right. I am using it like a film camera.
Are you still using it like a film camera?
Yes. None of the previews are on, and I don't look at anything until I get home.
You're so cool.
No.
Someday I'm going to be half as cool as you are.
It's an experiment. I think this is part of the self-editing. It's learning. Look, I'm still in the mode of learning the camera. I'm still in the mode of learning how the optical viewfinder on this camera, because I've never dealt with a rangefinder type of system where there's parallax and, you know, what you're seeing through the viewfinder is different than what the lens is recording. I've never dealt with that.
Is it that off?
For subjects that are far away, not so much. For subjects that are close,
yeah.
If I'm trying to shoot street portraits or, you know, shoot things that are within, let's say, 8-10 feet, yeah, it could be the difference between, you know, being in the sort of rule of thirds lines or cutting off somebody's eye.
Really? Mm-hmm. That much?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't notice the frame line problem on my Leica to be nearly that bad.
Well, you've been doing this a lot longer and well, actually, with that camera, yeah, you know.
Interesting.
It's just learning the quirks. But I don't take a lot of pictures. And again, that's purposeful. I'm not shooting. I'll look through the viewfinder quite a bit. In fact, when I'm wandering around, I'm looking through the viewfinder as I walk on sometimes, just to see if there's anything interesting. And if I see something that to my eye looks interesting, I'll take the picture and then
If you're doing that, optical viewfinder or electric?
Optical.
Right, because then you can see what's outside of the frame lines.
Uh-huh.
That is the huge...
Really neat.
Yes, that is like the huge advantage of rangefinders over SLR.
Yeah, it's really neat. I've never experienced something like this, so I'm like a kid in a candy store with this thing.
Well, you know, if you guys come visit next month or whatever we're going to plan on do, we'll go out one day and we'll pop a couple rolls into the Leica and you can shoot with that to see how it's different.
Yeah, no, that'd be great.
But yeah, it's fun to shoot. You could imagine how it felt to be Gary Winogrand or one of those guys, you know?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, to look at some of, okay, first of all, you've got all this stuff going on around you. You've got to try and whittle that down to something that looks interesting to your eye. You've got to time it correctly. You've got to, it's really fun stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, it's fun. It's like hunting.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
Well, I don't hunt, but I hear that that's what it's like.
It's like Duck Hunt on Super Nintendo.
It's Super Nintendo? Please.
Yeah. Well.
What'd you get that one for your 30th birthday?
Oh, there it is.
See what I did? Actually, that timing kind of works out, doesn't it?
A little bit. Jerk.
Do you think people get a crack out of our...
Yes, because it's become a thing now.
It's a thing?
Knuckleheads making fun of me.
Did we actually make fun of you?
That's all right. That's all right. You'll all rue the day.
Rue the day? Really? Did you just say that? Yeah. What are you going to do to us, old man? Hit us with your cane? Yeah. So we have a new sponsor this week.
We do.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Shutterstock.com.
Shutterstock.com.
They are on board with OTP.
That's right. They are down with OTP.
God, we're never going to let that go.
No.
Or somebody else isn't going to let that go.
Somewhere there are Shutterstock employees shaking their heads going,
yeah.
No, we're not.
Oh, boy. Yeah. So Shutterstock.com, where you'll find 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. 20 million,
Jeffrey. 20 million is huge.
Yeah, that's actually more than some of our listeners have on their own computers.
That's right. I bet they would have had the Marshall stacks that you.
You know what? Let me look. Hold on.
You should. So look, here's the thing.
They do. They have a whole bunch of them.
Do they really?
Okay. Yeah. So go ahead.
Would have saved you a trip into the city.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, go ahead. A click away. So what do they? What do? They give you a global image collection. So. If you need vectors, let's say you're a web designer. Let's take it out of photography. You're a web designer. You need some sort of vector border or edge or corner. Chances are they're going to have it for you.
It's true. I like the vector stuff because they probably have all those like cool arrow vectors and things. So when you're building something different for a site or whatever, those are the things you're always searching
to make.
Yes. Yeah. Worth the time. But you know what? It even makes sense for somebody like me, right? So I'm doing that picture of Dave Hill and I need a Marshall stack or I need a curtain or whatever it is. Yeah, I could take the time to go somewhere and find the thing and shoot the thing, or I could spend $19 for some small element of my picture.
Right.
And use that in the thing. And it's pay as you go. So it's like $19 for an image. You know, you could buy 5 images, $49. You could even subscribe
to these packages. The subscription service.
Yeah. So if you're using a whole bunch of pictures, you're running, you know, you're Josh Topolsky and you're running The Verge and you need stock photography all the time.
Right.
$250 a month. You could use 25 images a day. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. And I think, you know, I think there are a lot of photographers who could benefit from that. I know that, you know, there have been times, especially when I was teaching Photoshop, I use stock images all the time for doing lessons. I'm not going to go out and shoot that. I'm not a photographer. I'm not fancy like you.
You know, there's also, there's a whole other side of this that we don't think about, which is, you know what, you can, the people who listen to this show too, you have your photography. Go sell it for stock stuff that's sitting on your thing.
Friend of the show, Tim Dobbs. He's selling photographs.
Yeah, he's over in Wales. He's like hanging out in front of Torchwood headquarters there. And people love
that
picture.
Shot? Is that great?
Yeah, it's good stuff. But apparently, you can go on there and you can curate and share things. They have like a light box functionality where you can like say, oh, I put this one aside, put this one aside, put this one aside. And there's even an iPad app to do that. So when you're looking for just the right picture for whatever it is you're looking for, you can find it. So, you know, you can get enhanced license if you want to print it for run a print or swag for a trade show, something like that. You can get enhanced licensing for the image to do that kind of stuff. They've got everything. They got vectors. They got icons. They've got infographic templates, video clips. Not only just photography. They got all that other visual stuff to help your stuff look amazing.
Hey, what if you're making a photo book?
Yeah,
you know, vectors. You're going to use vectors for little elements, little ornaments.
Yeah,
things on page, and all that stuff takes a lot of time to make.
Jeffrey, it takes like 45 minutes to type a word or two.
It's true.
And they also have 24-hour support during the weekdays, 24-hour support. so right. you can get a hold of them in the middle of the night. So if you go sign up for a free browse account at Shutterstock.com, you don't need a credit card, nothing like that, just like Squarespace. And
okay, this is what's cool for me. Being able to look through all of these things, you're not having to pony up any money. Go look, see if they've got what you need.
Yep.
And if they do, you do an a la carte image, or if you need 50 images, do a monthly.
Yeah, absolutely. And what are they going to do for us? Because we don't want it to be just like, oh, go there and you get the same deal you got if you were just going there yesterday.
No, like you're some schmo.
Yeah, yeah. You listened on taking pictures. This is not messing around.
That's right. So you use the offer code PICTURES3, PICTURES the number 3. What do you think you're going to get? You're not going to get 10% off.
How about 15%?
No.
20%?
15%. What are we, one of those other shows?
20%.
Ah, keep going. 30. Okay. 30%.
30%?
30%.
That'll save you enough money to go buy something nice, like a liquid cooler for your computer.
That's right. Or at the very least, lunch at Shake Shack or Five Guys or something.
Oh, that's where I'm going after this. So yeah, if you go to Shutterstock.com, sign up for an account, go look for what see if they have what you need. If they do, great. If you're going to get a package, go for Pictures 3, get your 30% off any package on their menu. Shutterstock.com. We're excited to have them as a sponsor of On Taking Pictures.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're happy to have you guys aboard.
Yeah. All right, who's next?
Well, you've got this motorcycle thing. You want to talk about that? What is that? You always put these cryptic little things in the notes.
I do.
You won't
put
tell
cryptic
me beforehand.
Things in the notes. Here's okay. I was thinking about one of my.
Are you buying a motorcycle, Bill?
No. Although one of my favorite books ever is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. Love the book. I read it every few years. It had a whole bunch of meaning for myself and my relationship with my father. It has meaning for myself from the point of view of dealing with depression. I just think it's a fantastic book that makes me think every time I read it. And there's all these scenes in it where I think he drives, you know, some Honda, whatever. And the other guy, John, that he drives with has some fancy BMW motorcycle.
Okay.
And is very proud to have a BMW motorcycle. And it kind of got me thinking about we all talk about gear stuff. And I think somebody, was it Alan or somebody was talking this week, how he has a chunk of money. He wants to buy a whole bunch of gear. And which is fine. You know what? You need gear to take pictures.
I think his particular situation is kind of a use it or lose it type thing.
Yes, which is right, exactly. Which is still perfectly viable, right? You know, but it got me thinking about the fact that if photography is like a road trip, the motorcycle you choose to ride on is such a small part of the trip. Just like whatever camera you choose to use has so much less to do with the experience of taking photos. You know, so choosing your camera is like choosing your motorcycle. But if you don't actually ever take the motorcycle out on a road trip, you don't go take tons and tons of pictures, then you haven't gotten past first base. You know?
Okay. Yeah, I think that's by and large true.
So it's in some ways it's sort of like, you know, the old adage where people talk about, like, you know, some guy who's having a midlife crisis goes and buys a Harley but doesn't ever ride it and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Right.
I feel like a lot of the same kind of stuff happens in photography where people are like, oh, I'm going to get this camera and then I'm going to be this great photographer. It's like, no, that's step two, you know?
No, you won't.
Yeah, yeah. There's many steps along that road. And it kind of clicks in with the quote that somebody sent us the other day. Who sent it in? Carl sent it in.
Was this the Holmes?
Oliver Wendell Holmes. Which also, Oliver Wendell Holmes also has a really good quote about taxes. He says, taxes are the price we pay for a polite, civilized society, I think it is. And he was a conservative. Anyway, moving on. Apparently, Holmes said, quote, for the simplicity on this side of complexity, I wouldn't give a fig. But for the simplicity on the other side of complexity, for that, I would give you anything I have. And I think
so. That, what does this mean to you? What do you take away from that?
To me, it's sort of the idea when people go on these shoots. If you're going and taking pictures of somebody, and you are fiddling with your camera, you're thinking about all the settings. You're the technique is still something that you have to think about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you need to work on your technique. The point, you want to get all that stuff so you're not thinking about it and you're not panicking and you're not worrying about that as you're taking pictures. So in the sense of photography shooting, I see this as meaning, you have all your settings on, auto everything, and you're taking pictures when you first get your camera, and you're like, these pictures look pretty good. And then you start messing around with all the things that your camera can do because you're starting to get more deliberate about what you're trying to do. And you get into this lost world in the middle where everything's really difficult because there's so many variables.
Mm-hmm.
And that over time, you sort of get to this point where you're not thinking about that stuff anymore. And the simplicity of just the picture you're trying to take takes over again on the other side. And I think it fits in with this sort of the problem is trying to explain the difference between those two simplicities to somebody who's on the first side, you know, to them,
okay,
they look the same.
Who maybe they maybe can't see the other side of that.
Exactly.
Yet.
Yeah. They don't, okay, they don't understand that you're trying to get through to the other side where you're not thinking about all this stuff. By thinking about all this stuff obsessively, you want to get to the point where you're not thinking about it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, when you're playing with your camera, are you thinking about it obsessively?
I'm not thinking about it obsessively, but it's definitely conscious. I'm still learning. And someone who was, I think it was Alan, said I shouldn't refer to them as quirks. I should refer to them as features.
Yes. Yeah. Right.
So I'm still learning the features of this camera because it's different than what I'm used to. So I do feel like I'm at a disadvantage, but that disadvantage is what has sort of reinvigorated my excitement about making pictures.
Okay. Yeah. And that camera, for what it's worth, has probably a lot less features, quote unquote, than your average camera would.
Oh yeah, it does. It does. Absolutely.
Isn't it funny that we're getting to the point where not having features is itself a feature?
Yeah, that's a feature. Yeah, it's kind of funny.
There's a little bit of irony in all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, I just thought that was a great quote. Just the idea that there's simplicity. You know what it's like when my niece, you know, who's had all these health things when she was born. She was in the NICU and all that kind of stuff. And there would be nurses going in and out, and we'd be going in and out, and you know, it was like hectic and stress and confusing and differing information and you know, all that kind of stuff that comes along with medical situations like that. And there were a few doctors. There was her neurologist and her neurosurgeon who would come in, and it would feel like they were just sitting at the eye of the storm. That everything was just spinning around them about, you know, everything was just spinning around them, and they knew how to harness all that information, but they knew enough not to get stuck in the minutiae, you know? It's like they just had like complete control over what was going on. And I feel like that's sort of my goal when I'm working is to be the person who never let him see you sweat, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
You know,
right.
I want to make it look easy. Like that's the goal. Cause that both makes my clients and my subjects feel better about themselves, you know,
sure,
and trust me more.
But look, simple is the most difficult thing to do.
Yes.
Right.
Yep.
We posted a thing the other day on this guy. He's a title designer named Danny Yount.
Yunt.
Yunt, maybe. Y-O-U-N-T. I'm probably butchering your name, Danny, if you're listening. I doubt he is, but on the off chance. Anyway, this guy's designed you know, the opening titles and motion graphics for, you know, movies like Iron Man and Sherlock Holmes and, you know, all of these big budget movies where you've got probably teams of people and lots of resources at your disposal. And those are all well and good. But then for this other thing, he took out a 5D Mark II and an off-the-shelf copy of After Effects with no plugins whatsoever and still managed to make something amazingly compelling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like he's able to strip away all this other stuff and still make something cool. And that, I think, to your point, that's the difficult part, right, is getting to that point where you can strip away everything that's unnecessary and get to the simplicity of message and narrative and still create something cool.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's, I think that is part of the reason why we rail against Gear all the time, because Gear is adding complexity. It's not changing the equation. You know, it's like, yes, certain things make your life easier, but you should be able to do a lot of what you do without a whole lot of stuff around, you know, a lot of extra stuff. I think that that is a very good example. Yeah. It's like, what can you do with one, you know, one camera, one lens, one light, you know, go see what you can do. And it's a little bit like training. It's like doing cardio.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, I have to do cardio later today. I feel very lazy lately.
Well, you are. I think that would be an interesting, get together workshoppy kind of thing.
Maybe we should give assignments.
That could be,
you know, like
that could be,
on the Google Plus.
Yeah. And then, people could show their stuff either in the group. Maybe we could pick a couple and talk about them in the hangouts, you know, that kind of thing.
That might be an interesting thing to do. Like, you know, one camera, you know, a camera, one fixed focal length, something like, you know, 50 millimeter equivalent.
And if you don't have a prime, tape off your zoom.
Right. And then just sunlight, just the sun, not even other available light.
Okay.
Let's just talk sun, you know, bring it down to its most basic. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we should see what people do with that. So go take pictures and put them up.
On that, the next we did a kind of a test hangout, a few days ago, and, was kind of fun. So we're going to do another one on Friday, this coming Friday. I don't know. What's the date?
Friday 28th? Would be the 22nd.
22nd, Friday, the 22nd, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 a.m. or I'm sorry, 1 p.m. Eastern,
which would be, let's see, 6 p.m.
What is that UK time?
6 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, something like that.
So for
5 or 6.
So we've got some listeners in the UK.
In Europe, I think Portugal.
I think even Andrew Gibson may chime in.
Okay.
From New Zealand, which would be kind of cool.
That's going to be late for him.
Yeah.
Or maybe it'll probably be like 3 in the morning for him.
Yeah, well, he's young. He's got a lot of energy.
Kids nowadays and their boundless energy.
Staying up playing Xbox or whatever.
Embarrassing us. Hey, what do you think about the whole idea of some people are talking about this Google Glass kind of stuff, like having a camera on you at all times so the camera sees what you see.
I think it's silly. It's silly. It's crazy.
What do you mean silly?
Most people's lives are not that interesting.
Okay.
As a gross generalization, I mean, you go to work, you come home, you're in the car. I don't want to watch 2 hours of some knucklehead driving to work in a commute.
Right, right.
You know, look, I think Google is putting a lot into Glass, and it's definitely going to be a niche thing, especially at the price point that they're currently at. There was an interesting article from former CEO of Apple, John Sculley.
Okay.
Talking about how Apple they've got to reinvent themselves with something, that next one big thing that Steve used to call it. And his thing is some sort of wearable sensors that there will be, we will be recording various aspects of our lives all the time. And I just don't feel like we're recording it enough.
I think Google Glass is cool from the point of view of like, here, show me directions to where I'm going within my line of view, you know, or pop up a message that's really important so I can see it while I'm walking down the street. I don't need one, but I could see that being a thing. Like the whole, like people are talking about watches and stuff like that. Ugh, I don't want to wear a watch. Watches are terrible.
It's
still got to look down at a watch. How much information is it going to hold?
It's almost getting to, did you see,
less features is more features.
Yeah. What's the Tom Cruise sci-fi movie?
The recent one?
Spielberg directed.
That would be Minority Report.
Minority Report. That's the one. Philip K. Dick. Where he's walking through the mall and he's got, because everybody's got the optical implants. So it's like, hello, John Anderton, you were at the Gap last time. And do you want to get these same? I don't want that.
It's already happening. What do you think happens when you see ads for Amazon or, you know? I don't think we need to go any deeper into that. Going any deeper into that is not going to yield benefits for your average person.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I love having
the internet in my pocket.
Yeah.
I don't need it on my wrist or on my eye, you know?
I get distracted too easily to wear those glasses. I would end up bumping into things and, I mean, yeah.
You already bump into things.
That's
true. You're like Mr.
Really
Magoo. Yeah, they don't do anything for me.
It's very strange. I'm sure, again, it'll be a niche thing and maybe it'll catch on, but... I don't think it's ready for prime time from an application standpoint yet. I mean, we've been reading about wearable computers for 25 years, but there still hasn't been, to my knowledge, a compelling reason to do it other than because we can.
Right. Yeah, true.
That's not good enough for me personally.
It's not good enough for you. Nothing's good enough for you, man.
That's right.
You're going to put the show notes, the storytelling video you were talking about?
Yeah, that's in there. Okay. Sometimes quantity leads to quality.
And I like this underwater photography from the 50s thing.
This is kind of interesting. This is a stunt woman? What is this?
Yeah, I guess she was a stunt woman at the time. Yeah. But just the idea that... Well, I guess back in the day, it was stunt women who were doing this stuff. Nowadays, they make your average actress for a Vanity Fair thing, you know. But it's another example of where everything all these new things that keep coming out have been done, you know.
Right. Like, right. Yeah. What was it? Was it Jill Greenberg that did a whole series underwater?
Yeah. There's those really beautiful photographs of the guy's got like a girl in like a beautiful gown underwater inside of a room that's underwater. Like he built sets underwater. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
That guy.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff is amazing. These pictures were used for MGM, to promote something, but it's just interesting to me that everything that, you know, goes around, comes around. These things were doing some fancy, fancy stuff. You ever use an underwater camera?
A friend of mine, yes, is the short answer. A friend of mine in high school had one of the, Nikonos, I guess it would have been a four then, Nikonos four, the underwater cameras that Nikon made.
Okay.
And we kind of messed around with it. It's interesting. I could never do it, at least in the ocean, because I don't do that. I don't go in the ocean like that. No.
You don't go in the ocean?
No.
Is this something you want to talk about?
No.
Okay.
No, I just, the idea of, you know, 42 tons of water between me and oxygen. Mm-mm. No interest.
Okay. Does it bother you to think that there's big giant animals underneath your feet too?
Yes.
Yeah. So you don't even put your feet in, like wade in?
No, I'll go in like a little bit, but plus the, you know, a lot of the beaches in Southern California are filthy. So, you know,
which is ironic considering that's why a lot of people move to Southern California.
No. I don't like Southern California sandy beaches. I mean, I like the beach that we were at, the Corona del Mar, where it's like rocky beaches. It's more like a New Englandy type feel, right?
Yeah. Or a Pacific Northwestern feel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like Cannon Beach in Oregon.
Sure, yeah. Or, you know, the Washington coastline or something.
Yeah.
Beach, no. You end up feeling sticky and dirty and ugh, no.
Sounds like a personal problem, Jeffrey.
It might be.
Hey, you know, this week, just as a little aside, I'm Cisco, Francisco Graciano, who are a friend of the show. Friend of mine, friend of the show.
And world famous dancer. And,
oh, pff, yeah. Okay, yeah, there's that too.
And that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He just happens to be a dancer for like one of the most famous companies. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's eating cheeseburgers and shakes and still losing weight. What's that about?
Yeah, he was over here eating donuts, and he's like, yeah, I'm looking a little skinny this week. Yeah, sure you are, bastard.
Sure you are, Cisco. Keep believing.
As I look down, and there's just like tires growing on my side. Well, he's a very exciting photographer as well. He shoots a lot backstage while they're like touring and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, he's got the access, right?
Yeah,
he's
man. He's got it like set up. And so he came to me the other day. He's like, I want to build a new computer. So we're building a Hackintosh for him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you get off of your mic?
No.
Okay. Oh, you're back a little louder. You just got quiet for a minute there.
It was one of those.
Okay. And so we bought all the parts. We ordered them. He was over here on Sunday. He ordered them yesterday and almost everything showed up this morning. We're putting in a water cooler.
Yeah, that's like going to be a little hot rod.
A little liquid cooler pump. And then got one of these 27-inch HP monitor. LED backlit, IPS display, $660.
Yeah. Now, what's the model number on that? Because HP makes two different 27s.
That is a good question, but I can go on to the Newegg and find out. The thing that
it
I like
about
it
looks like a gorgeous screen.
Yeah, and it got there was a review on I think it's the could it be this one? Yeah, it could be this one. The ZR2740W.
Okay.
And the cool thing about it is that it got good reviews on Anantech, and they calibrated and stuff and got it down to like a 1.2 delta E, which is pretty good for a $600 monitor. It doesn't have internal lookup tables. It's not super fancy. It doesn't have crazy big backlighting, but you know what? My backlighting causes my electric bill to be like $80 a month in my little apartment in New York City. So, you know,
it looks like LED's a nice screen.
Yeah, really nice. We pulled it out and we were playing with it. So anyway.
Slim bezel around the screen
small,
itself.
It's light. It turns on instantly because it's LED backlit. So we're going to do that. Overclock i5 quad core. We're going to put the little cooler on it. One 120 gig SSD, two terabyte drives, one backing up to the other.
Screamer.
It's going to be the Bill Wadman backup solution.
Yes. And it's good.
Anyway, so this monitor is really impressive. So when I build his computer and I calibrate it, we're going to see how good it is. But, you know, this might be a good solution for those of you who want to buy a good monitor but don't want to spend $1,400.
Ballpark total for hardware, for the entire machine, including screen.
This whole machine, including screen, is almost $2,000. But
it's a great price.
But it's going to be super fast. And it's all super high-quality parts. Like, we bought a fancy motherboard, and we're going to use DisplayPort, just the Intel graphics, no other graphics card. Cause you know what? All 2D stuff, it's going to be fine.
No, it's going to be great. Screen. And it's all components that have been tested by our favorite custom Mac community site, Tony Mac.
Yeah.
So it should be pretty seamless.
You know, for all the 5x5 people who are listening to us now, you may have missed, we did a Hackintosh episode. We should put a link in the show notes. Cause I did not upload that into the 5x5,
Oh, yeah, you should. That was a good episode.
Yeah, but, you know, let's just link to it over on my thing because it was sort of out of the numbers, and I don't want it to screw up our number system.
Okay.
But we'll put a link in the show notes so you can go listen to the Hackintosh thing because we both Jeffrey and I are big Hackintosh fans. All right, so who's our photographer of the week?
Our photographer of the week, Anton Corbijn.
Oh, now where would I know this gentleman?
Anton Corbijn, a lot of music photography. If you've ever seen photos of U2 or Tom Waits or Depeche Mode, you have seen Anton Corbijn's work. He's shot Metallica. He's shot models, actors, very like high contrast black and white is a lot of his stuff, or sepia or selenium toned images.
Okay.
Not a lot of color work.
Yeah, and very contrasty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like everything is like hyper contrasty. Do you think too contrasty?
No, I think he has kind of defined a style for himself because that's the way he shot. That's it's kind of the way he's always shot, right?
Yeah.
He didn't just arrive at it because, you know, he's some hipster. I think this is the way he's shot since he first started, and it's just it kind of works for him.
Are you saying that he's not just a hipster?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
He's more than a hipster?
Yeah. More is the
more than a hipster.
Do you like Boston? Do you like that band? Do what?
You like that band Boston?
No.
Okay. Because that was probably after you retired, right? That came out?
They came out?
Yeah, right.
He's got some great photographs of David Bowie, of one of my favorite artists of all time, David Sylvian. He's got some fantastic photographs of David Sylvian. If you are a Depeche Mode fan, the new Depeche Mode record, which I think is called, what's it called? The Delta Machine? I think it's called the Delta Machine. The deluxe edition of Delta Machine comes with a little hardcover book of his photographs, of Anton Corbijn's photographs.
Okay.
Also, a film director. Directed The American with George Clooney, which you liked.
He definitely has a look to his stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I think it's very distinctive once you actually see a bunch of his pictures all in one place. And did you mention the book of him and Tom Waits?
I didn't mention it, but yeah, there's a book of fantastic Tom Waits photographs.
Yeah.
I think both of us are pretty big fans of Tom Waits.
I didn't used to be, but I have become since the fall. Is that wrong of me?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I've kind of come to really respect him. There's something about it's the way he talks, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. I think some people listen to my music and you know, they find something in something I did, and and that's great. You know, I don't know.
It's kind of like that, right?
I don't know if that was Tom Waits or Louis Armstrong.
No, it's great. It's Tom Waits. I'm telling you, it's Tom Waits. I'm a fan of Tom Waits and this guy's photography. In fact, that book's coming out. I think I want to buy a copy. I should look for that, huh?
I think you should.
I think I should buy it now while I can.
You know, we've talked about books in both online and offline. A lot of these photography books, you think, oh, I'll get it, you know, next time, or I'll get it later on, and you find out that they go out of print, and then they're $400 on eBay or something.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And so I think that I'm actually going to make a point of starting to buy more photography books, almost as an investment.
Mm-hmm. I think it's May.
Is it not out yet?
No.
It's not. It's funny. It's not even listed on Amazon yet. Although, there it is. Yeah,
it is.
Oh, there it is. Hardcover. It's coming out. It's not available yet.
Waits, Corbijn.
Yeah.
Corbijn.
Yeah. That's good stuff, though.
That's not quite as good as
Robert Duvanneau. Robert Duvanneau
or Stéphane Louveau, who is another monster. God, did you see some of the stuff he's been posting lately?
With that beautiful dark-skinned black woman. Oh, love that shot. Yeah. That guy is such a monster.
Yeah.
Someday I'm going to go over to Paris. I'm going to look him up. I'm going to meet him, and I'm just going to slap him across the face.
And give him your business card and then leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, hi, really nice to meet you.
no words exchanged whatsoever.
Yeah, I just look at him and I recognize him, and he looks at me, and I look at him, and just like, psh. That would be really funny, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's remind people how they can get a hold of us. Send us some emails.
Yeah, we get great emails. Keep them coming. We love reading them. The feedback on the Google Plus group has been fantastic. It is, I think it's just bit.ly/OTP group.
Okay.
So bit.ly/OTP group is the address.
And our email address?
podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
And you and I both tweet. I am at Bill Wadman, WADMAN. And you are at Jeffrey Storrs, JEFFERY, not R-E-Y.
E-R-Y. I know. Even Hattie gave me grief about that. Both Hattie and Dan.
Yeah. And then.
Like, what's wrong with your parents?
Now, Sidoris, DDD1R.
DDD1R.
And so go send us some stuff. Oh, and one other thing, the voicemail, because, man, that voicemail we got last week.
Okay. Yeah. Tom's
Jeffrey,
voicemail
you
awesome.
You are triggering an atomic bomb of photography madness.
That's right.
Madness
you guys
lit
an atomic bomb of photography madness. That's right.
Such a great
347-687-9411. 347-687-9411.
Okay. Thank you once again to Shutterstock. Welcome. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Yeah. Well, some of you this week.
Oh, yeah. Friday. At 1 p.m. Friday. Eastern.
Hey, I don't know how that's going to work. Is there a limit? Are we going to have to like limit it to X number of people? Because there's like a lot of people.
The only limitations are the limitations in your mind.
Great. We'll wing it. We'll just see how it goes.
Okay. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
So have a good week, everyone, and we'll see you later.
Okay.